Hello, my beautiful listeners. Welcome, come one, come all. Welcome to the show. It's good to be back. First thing I want to do, I want to start off today, the episode here today. First off, welcome to the Weekend Sports Rep Podcast. We're back. Thank you for coming back. We appreciate it very much. Please remember to rate and follow this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, on any of those popular podcasting platforms. I'd greatly appreciate it. Tell your friends about us. Greatly appreciate that as well. First thing is first today. I want to start off today by giving us a very big round of applause. It is deserved. You know why? Because I believe, maybe it wasn't this podcast or in particular, but the podcasting audience, maybe it was you guys. I don't know. Maybe it was somebody else. At the very least, we were part of the grouping. Okay. They changed the kickoff rules in the NFL. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all thanks to, maybe us, maybe a little smidge of us, maybe not all of us, maybe a little smidge of us, because we were advocates. We said, hey, you can look at the title of the episode not too long ago. A couple weeks ago, maybe something like that. You can look at the title. It says the NFL needs to fix the kickoff rules. And lo and behold, I don't think Roger Goodell's listening, or the owners of any popular NFL franchises are listening to this program. Not by any means. But you know what? We were in the pool of people that were like, we need change. We need change for the betterment of the NFL, for the betterment of the sport. And guess what happened? It happened. They changed it. The betterment of the sport is going to, it's only going to increase from here. Okay. The kickoff rules, the kickoff formations and whatnot are all changing going into next year, which is awesome. I'm so happy they decided to do that. It was kind of like it wasn't like a super big surprise, but it was kind of an immediate turnaround. It was brought to the owners by the Players Association or vice versa. But it happened relatively quickly where they were like, hey, we've got these new rules that we're going to implement for kickoffs next year. What are your thoughts? And basically everybody was unanimous in agreement and said, yeah, let's do it. Let's try it for next year. And bada bing, bada boom, here we are. New rules in place. And now we get the new kickoff, and it's going to bring excitement back to kickoffs in the NFL. I'm super excited for this to become a thing. They're essentially bringing in what was the XFL's rules, which was you got two teams starting at, I can't remember which exact yard marker it is, but they're standing 10 yards apart. And once the kickoff happens, once the returner catches the ball, that's when both teams can go towards each other and then start to block one another for the returner, or try to tackle the returner if you're on the kicking team. It's super cool. I'm so excited that it's happening. You're going to see a lot more. I think we're going to see some more like counteractions happen from teams receiving and stuff. Make it look like it's a big counter read. So you'll get return blockers pulling from one section and then coming around and creating a separate lane. I think that's going to be really cool. It's just going to create more situations where you can get more creative with the kickoffs and the return schemes and whatnot. It's going to create a whole new avenue for special teams. I think it's really cool. We're going to get to finally see more kickoff returns. And that's just good action in general for the sport of football. And it's just going to be safer, I think, for the most part. Even when, you know, we didn't get very many kickoffs in general, kickoffs returned were in general. And when they did, you know, it was just kind of full speed, a little bit dangerous, obviously. I am a full-on advocate of the change with the kickoff rule for the NFL. And I think more teams or more leagues should do it, to be honest with you. I'd be more relieved to see like high school football kind of switch to this sort of kickoff situation. I would like to see college football teams implement it. We get less touchbacks in college football. But it's still a huge amount of touchbacks that happen from kickoffs, obviously. So I would like to see college do it as well. I think it would be very cool. It's an interest. It would be, you know, at the very least, you're preparing them for their NFL dreams. If you're a returner or a blocker or whatever on a special teams, I think it'd be very smart. So we made the change. We were one of the groups that said, hey, this needs to change. We need to bring the kickoff back to what it once was. But a more safer version of it. We just want the action back from kickoffs, the excitement that came from kickoff returns. And ladies and gentlemen, guess what? I think we got it. I think we actually got it. I'm curious to see what happens with it, how the NFL players like it. Seemingly, with how quickly it went through in terms of the rule change happening, clearly the Players Association was like, yep, we're totally on board with this. Let's do it. Let's try it out. And we'll see what happens. And then the other thing that they went through, which is going to be more of a little bit harder to get people excited for. They did, in fact, ban the hip drop tackle, which was very interesting to me. I didn't think that they were going to be able to get that through and have that approved by both sides. And it did. It was banned. I am for one. I am one for making the game safer in every version, no matter what. Now, granted, it's football, it's the NFL. I understand that it's going to be dangerous no matter what happens. But, you know, if they can find something that will decrease the likelihood of major injuries such as torn ACLs, torn Achilles and whatnot, I'm okay with that. But with that being said, there is an advantage. I think this is one thing that baseball and the major in the MLB has an advantage over the NFL on. And that is the minor league system that the MLB has. I don't think they could implement that. Like, the NFL could never have a minor league system, even though they kind of do with college football. But, you know, that's a conversation for another day, and it's a different animal. But the minor league system that the MLB has allows them to kind of put these different rule changes for a number of years before they're actually implemented into the major leagues. So the pitch clock, which they introduced last year, was not a brand new concept to the MLB. They had been testing that for years in other, you know, pioneer leagues or minor league systems for years, years and years and years until they kind of perfected it, got it down to a certain point where it would work well in the MLB. And I think that is something that the MLB kind of has a step up, you know, and it's not very many things that the MLB has an advantage over the NFL. That the MLB has an advantage over the NFL. But that is one of them. I think having that minor league system, that kind of training ground where you can kind of train players and see the results from these trains, these tests, if you will, and how they would be implemented into the MLB was a huge advantage that the MLB has. And not even, you know, not just the pitch clock. We're seeing the robot umps become, or the review system on balls and strikes and whatnot, not necessarily the robot umps. That sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger is standing behind home plate and is calling balls and strikes. The review system for the strike zone in minor leagues is being tested out as well. And apparently the tests are going relatively well. It's a simple system, and minor league players and the calls in the minor leagues for balls and strikes are drastically changing for the better. You know, more balls are calling more borderline balls are calling balls, and then more borderline strikes are being called strikes and whatnot. And I think that is going to be eventually implemented into the MLB, and I think that's going to be for the better. And the NFL doesn't really have that, which is going to become interesting for stuff like this hip drop tackle rule, where they don't have really a testing ground where they can, you know, ban the hip drop tackle in a certain league, see how it plays out, see what ends up happening. Does it actually change the amount of injuries? Are these penalties being called often, and is it hurting the actual overall performance of the game? You know, they don't have an area to kind of test that. And the NFL is just kind of what the proving ground or the testing ground is. It's the entire NFL. If they end up hating it, they can ban it going into next season, obviously, but that's not really what you want to end up doing, because then the product just becomes muddled and confusing because you don't know which rule is going into the season and which rule is being taken out heading into the season. It just becomes confusing. So I think the MLB has an advantage in that sense, where they can kind of test all this stuff, work out all the kinks heading into an MLB season. Granted, the pitch clock had some issues towards the beginning of spring training last year, but then by the time spring training was over, for the most part, a lot of the teams and a lot of pitchers, a lot of batters had kind of worked it out. They'd kind of figured it out. We're seeing a lot less pitch clock violations from pitchers and batters this year than we had in the previous year, especially early in the season. Now, the problem is for the NFL is I don't think they actually, there's really no other way that they can kind of create that testing ground, you know, because the NFL, there's only football in general, there's only a certain amount of time that you're really getting the prime out of guys, and only a certain amount of time that you're actually, which is kind of dark to say, you're getting the healthiest version of people. And for the NFL, they want those people on their teams now, and they're not going to have people going down to the minor leagues or what have you, and especially at the risk of possible injury and whatnot in a minor league system that isn't their own, you know, their own team at the very top of the league. So it's a lot harder for them to implement. Obviously, I'm not saying they need to call for a minor league system or anything like that, because I don't think that would work. But the advantage that baseball has, that the MLB has with this system of minor leagues, where they can kind of test these new rules and whatnot, is kind of significant, because you're not really seeing a situation in which the MLB is bringing up these rules after years of testing and having a whole serious amount of flaws with them. Again, pitch clock was kind of an issue at the beginning of last year, but everybody kind of has worked it out at this point. They know what they're doing. Pitchers know what they're doing. There's not really a huge issue with it anymore. You can kind of discuss the injury situation, but until we see more evidence of like pitchers actually getting injured more frequently because of the pitch clock, I don't necessarily, personally for me, I don't see the connection there, because we've had plenty of pitchers that have worked incredibly fast over the years without the pitch clock, that have, you know, avoided injury and whatnot. So there's just the connection that they're trying to bring in there is interesting and very confusing to me. But they brought the pitch clock up. The pitch clock up, and it hasn't been a huge major issue going into the second year of it. I'll be interested to see what they do with the strike zone review type situation, the umpire or the behind home plate review, the strike zone situation, because that is going to be changed eventually. I don't think there is a scenario in which they continue on the path that they're on, where we're seeing so many, you know, balls be called strikes and vice versa, that can be, you know, where these guys have kind of honed in their strike zone to the millimeter with their own eyes, and to have that kind of blown up by a person behind home plate. You know, I think that's going to change eventually. We're going to see changes in umpiring and whatnot, whether it be robot strike zone or what have you. I don't know what the end goal is of that, but I do think we're going to see change in that. It'll be interesting to see how that's implemented in the MLB. Another one, the league-wide DH, I think, was met with some hard-headedness, I would say, from the older crowd, because they wanted to see every, you know, 1 through 9 pitchers hit as well. But I think as we enter, I don't even know how long that one's been, probably 3-4 years now, I think that one has been kind of universally as accepted as this is a better version of the game, which is true. The universal DH, it should have been implemented a long time ago, to be honest with you. I'm surprised it took this long. But the universal DH has just made the game a more fun watch, because you don't have the 9-hole hitter, which has been a pitcher, if it's not Zach Greinke, Madison Bumgarner, or Clayton Kershaw coming to the plate, just kind of be an easy out. You know, people walking the 8-hole batter just to bring up the 9-hole batter with 2 outs in the inning, just an easy out, and or walking the 8-hole batter with 1 out down and having the pitcher come up and ground into an easy double play. You know, you're just not seeing anymore. So that's better. I think that is universally, maybe not universally loved, but I think it's accepted at this point. We're like, okay, this is a better version of the game. There are still probably some, you know, some classical MLB people that are like, this is not good for the game. We want to see the pitchers hit, but it's like, do you really want to watch the pitchers hit? You know, do we really want to watch the pitchers hit? I've never understood that argument where you want to see somebody who's not good at something, not good at hitting, outside of a couple people in the league who are not good at hitting the baseball. You want to see them come up and try to hit the baseball? Doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand it. I've never understood that argument. You can bring up the strategy thing, but you can still have that strategy with the 9-hole hitter coming up to the top of the lineup with a regular hitter. You know, it's just, it's the whole strategy thing. That argument was so confusing to me. But yeah, this proving ground that the MLB has had, it's been very advantageous for them. They haven't really implemented anything over the past few years where I've been like, that isn't a good implementation. That's not well thought out. This hasn't been done very well because they've had the years of testing, and the NFL has not had that. And they're implementing this hip drop tackle ban, which is going straight into the NFL this upcoming year. And also, you know, a lot of the other rules that they've come up with, whether it be the targeting rule and whatnot, which granted, I think that's a good rule to have, obviously, but because it is kind of vague and it wasn't fleshed out when it first came into the league, there's still problems with it. There's still problems with what it is exactly, the catch rule, which is another one. There's just a lot of these that are just kind of thrown into the NFL, and the thought is it'll work itself out, which some of them, you know, kind of have, but it's not good for fans who leave the game at the end of the season. They don't really pay any attention to anything that's happening in the offseason, and then come back and watch again. They're going to have these new rules and be like, what's happening here? Why is that a penalty? When did that become a thing? And that's kind of been prominent over the last few years. And it's like, when did that become a, when did that become a penalty and whatnot? And that's kind of an issue for the NFL and, you know, people that watch football in general. And I don't think there's really a fix for it. You just kind of have to live with it, which is not great. Because again, if it's this hip drop tackle rule, comes back and it's just kind of a disaster. It's not shrinking penalties or anything like that. And then they take it out again. It's just, you're confusing fans, you're confusing players. I don't know how they really change it, because there's no way they'll implement a minor league system or anything like that, unless, and this is kind of the weird world that we could possibly be going into, especially with how college football is operating now. The NFL just says, hey, college sports, college football teams, if you want to join this league, we'll pay you a certain amount of money and you can kind of become our minor league system, quote unquote, and it's full of like 60 teams or something. And they're paying the universities to do that. And the football teams are coming in and they're now just a proving ground, essentially for these NFL teams, essentially a 16 week season. That is essentially a combine. That's the dark area. I don't want that to ever happen. I really, really hope that doesn't happen, but I could kind of see it where the NFL is essentially just saying, hey, we'll pay you a certain amount of money. You come play as a quote unquote subsidiary of the NFL. And we'll pay your university a certain amount of money, and these teams will play under us. We'll implement some rules to you to see how they work out going into the NFL. And, you know, we're paying you a substantial amount of money because the NFL makes a unbelievable amount of money. And then, you know, that's how we'll flush it out. I hope that's not what happens. I really hope that is not what happens. But I could see it. I could definitely see it. NFL makes more money than God, and if they had, if they were able to, you know, essentially buy up very popular universities, they would have the money going, the college football money as well, which would be insane. They would make even more money. So, interesting. An interesting thought to think about. I don't know if the universities would do that. They could do that. They could do that if they wanted to, because that's extra money in the bank for universities. You know, not having to seek out donors as often or anything like that. Just getting it from the NFL because they put the football program as a subsidiary of the NFL. No other ties to the university. They're just taking donations from the NFL to put the football program under the NFL as a second division type of thing. I don't know. I hope that's not what happens. I would hate it. I would absolutely despise it. I don't like the NCAA already. And then making the NFL some sort of version, or making college football some sort of subsidiary of the NFL. I don't know how much that would improve things, but it would make the testing ground for the NFL a lot better. And they would be able to test out these rules and kind of, you know, kind of fix them in a way that would make it more applicable to the NFL. And then they would kind of fix it. But I would hate it because that would suck for college football. That would really suck for college football. So I hope that doesn't happen, but we'll see. There's a lot of money riding on a lot of this, on the sports, the NFL, college football as well, and just tying it all together. If you're the NFL, you know, what else would you want? You know, that would be great for them. Okay, that is, I mean, I mainly wanted to celebrate the kickoff thing because getting the kickoffs fixed, essentially. We'll see how it plays in the NFL. We'll see how it kind of plays out. I can't imagine it goes poorly. I just think it's going to be more fun to watch, more entertaining. Everybody's going to, instead of just skipping the first kickoff of the game and the first second half kickoff of the game, you're going to sit down and want to watch it, which is good. That's always good for football. So I'm interested to see what happens. I'm curious to see how it goes in the NFL.
Whether it's installing a new system or taking care of what you have, there's a lot to consider when it comes to heating and cooling your home or small business, and that's where Alpine Climate Control excels. See more about the systems they install and service, and even schedule a consultation online at alpineclimatecontrol.com. You can also stop by and see their showroom with all working models of gas fireplaces, pellet stoves, pizza ovens, and more. Alpine Climate Control, just north of Sheridan College at 2705 Coffeen Avenue in Sheridan.
It was a big night for women's college basketball last night, obviously. South Carolina versus Iowa. South Carolina national championships, an undefeated season. Dawn Staley, one of the great coaches of her time. She was amazing. Taking a nearly going undefeated last year as well, but they lost to Iowa in the Final Four last year. Avenging that loss from a year ago, finishing an undefeated season. A very deserved national champion, obviously. And Caitlin Clark goes out, not necessarily with a win, but leaving her mark on not just the women's college game, the college basketball in general, leaving her mark on the game. She's going to be the number one overall pick in the upcoming WNBA draft. Going to go to the, I think it's the Indiana Fever, if I remember correctly. I apologize if I'm getting the name wrong. Still learning all this. I apologize. But it is interesting to see how much really this has kind of come alive over the past 6 months. And, you know, it's probably been a lot longer, but now it's becoming more, it's become a lot more into the normal person spotlight, if that makes sense. If I asked my mom who Caitlin Clark was, she would probably know the answer to that. And before this, I don't know if she could name, you know, a single, not just a women's college basketball player, a college basketball player. And now Caitlin Clark has become a household name, and it's only going to improve the women's game in general because it is getting more eyes on the women's game. And it's really good to see we're having, this is kind of how I know we made it. For the women's game, how the women's game has kind of made it. We're having really, really, really stupid discussions on popular hot take shows on any, you know, popular sports media companies, you know, not just one in particular, there's multiple. But that's kind of how you know the women's game has made it. You know, we're having these ridiculous takes on these shows, and you know, it sucks for that part of it. I hate that we're discussing it that stupidly. That's just kind of how it works for the world of sports talk right now. Unfortunately, I kind of wish we still had like a sports reporter show or something like that, where we could talk about how much this sport has really grown in, and it's been longer than 6 months, but really the rapid growth over this past 6 months with Caitlin Clark chasing the record and then Caitlin Clark breaking the record, kind of going in on a run towards the end of the season, making a really good run into the NCAA tournament, going through a crazy gauntlet of teams in the NCAA tournament and getting to the national championship game, and how it has really shifted the mindset based on women's basketball, women's college sports in general. I've always been a very big advocate for like women, like softball in college softball, because I think it's really good. I think softball in college, women's college softball is really good. I'm an Oklahoma fan though, and they've been very dominant over the past few years, obviously. So that kind of sways my opinion a little bit. But that is a very fun game to watch. And now they don't really have that, you know, that number one person that they could kind of point to and be like, yeah, this is the person that picked the sport up. And picked the sport up is derogatory. It's not the correct version, but maybe raised it to another level. Whereas I think women's college basketball now could kind of point to Caitlin Clark as that person. And then now we have a whole new area of women's college athletes that are going to be propped up, women's college basketball stars that are going to be propped up on this run. Juju Watkins, a freshman for USC, is going to be a huge name at USC, maybe not necessarily at USC, but in the college game as well for a long time. I don't know if she'll make it, you know, she'll go full senior, full 4-year ride or anything like that, but Juju Watkins is going to be in college basketball for a while. Haley Van Lith is another one. There's plenty of names you can go with. There are a couple leaving this year that's going to be, you know, that's going to be a tough loss. Obviously, Cameron Brink being one of them. Angel Reese being another one of them. Caitlin Clark, obviously. But I think it is kind of ushering a new age of college athletics, where I think the women's game is going to see a rise in the names that we kind of remember, if that makes sense. In the men's game, we had a lot of guys that came through, especially earlier in the, you know, early 2000s, the 90s, the 80s and stuff like that, where you would have guys come up, go a full 4 years, and you would remember those teams, those players' names throughout the full 4 years. Patrick Ewing with Georgetown, Carmelo Anthony with Syracuse. I don't know if he went a full 4 years. I can't remember. But there were those names that you could remember that were stuck on your team for a certain amount of time. And you knew those guys were going to be there. You knew when they were going to be leaving, that sort of stuff. We didn't have, then that's really changed with how the NBA has implemented, you know, the one and dones and whatnot. And I don't think that's necessarily the primary factor for it, but I do think that because we're seeing more longevity in the women's game, maybe not all because of NIL, but NIL is a big part of it. If you're able to get paid in college as a college basketball player and having eyes on you in college basketball, maybe you'll have more eyes on you at Stanford or what have you than if you went to, you know, somewhere else in the WNBA, clear across the country. You know, that's not going to matter for Caitlin Clark. She's going to be fine. She's going to make a ton of money, obviously, in the WNBA, or if she stays in college, she's obviously just going to the WNBA regardless. But if she were to stay, it wouldn't really matter. But for the lower tiered players in women's college basketball who are staying there for all 4 years and whatnot and still making a decent amount of money off of NIL, I think it's going to help the longer noticeability of each player. And I think it's only going to help the women's college basketball game. And I think it's great. And I'm Caitlin Clark can be, you know, that person that kind of brought it up, rose it to a certain level. I don't know, you know, next in line could be Juju Watkins. It could be a couple of people, but it feels like it's probably just Juju Watkins. But you know, I think there's plenty of players in the women's game. And not to mention the women's game, I think people tend to forget this. We always compare it to the NBA to a certain extent, but the women's game on a professional level has not been around for that long. Like if we're talking WNBA, an American professional, you know, affiliation with the NBA, the top tier of women's professional basketball, that came around, that started in June of 97. I was born after the start of the WNBA. I was born July of 97. So it's still a very early, like, you know, basketball has always been around forever, but since basketball was invented, it was mainly men playing it. So the comparison from the WNBA to NBA to the WNBA and the difference in game, you're talking about an evolution of a game for the NBA, for the men's style of game, for like 70 years, if not more than that, 70 plus years of the men's game. And the WNBA is still kind of just starting. The professional circuit for women's college or women's basketball, women's professional basketball in America is essentially like 27 years old. So the comparison between the two is just not fair. You're talking about a league that had money flooded into it from the beginning. It has support from the beginning, and then it was brought to, and then the women's league, who was brought in by that league, fair enough, but was not necessarily supported on the same levels as the NBA was for a long time. It's kind of now, especially from the men's their counterparts in the sport, and now it's kind of being switched around where we're seeing a lot more men in the NBA become advocates for the WNBA and a lot of the women in that sport. And it's just, you know, if those people lead, then more people will follow and go and watch the WNBA because it's a solid product. It's a very good product. It's a very good basketball product. And it's, you know, it's basketball. It's basketball. That's all you can ask for is it's basketball, you know? I'm curious to see what happens in the women's sport, the women's college game. Now that Caitlin Clark is gone, who's going to kind of step up? Nobody's going to kind of be in the limelight as much as she was, but someone is going to have to step up and kind of become that next face of women's college basketball. And I think when Caitlin Clark gets into the WNBA this, you know, upcoming summer, when she is drafted into the WNBA, where, like, is she going to immediately become the face of the WNBA, or is she going to have to go over the Sabrinas, the Aaliyah Bostons, the Breonna Stewarts, the Brittany Griners? You know, is she going to have a bigger mountain to climb, or is she immediately kind of going to have that? And, you know, people are going to know her, obviously. That's not really what I'm asking, but more like, is she going to have the same impact going into the WNBA as she did in college? It'll be interesting. I'm curious to see what happens with the women's college game and the WNBA as Caitlin Clark heads into the, not just Caitlin Clark either, Cameron Brink, who I mentioned before, the Naismith Defensive Player of the Year for Stanford, going to be a very good player in the WNBA. Angel Reese, who has been a very good player for LSU for a long time, is heading into the WNBA as well. So, you know, lots of players going into the WNBA this year. Kind of feels like a newer generation heading in that people can kind of ride along with and become a new favorite, become a fan of a team they hadn't watched before. Like, you know, the Caitlin Clark is going to go to the Indiana Fever. I can't remember that. I believe that's the name of their team. I apologize. I'm going to look it up really quick. Indiana WNBA team. It's the Fever. Okay, I figured it was the Fever. I was like 80% sure it was the Fever. But yeah, the Indiana Fever, is that going to bring in a lot more people who are fans of the Fever? Probably. I would assume a lot. I would assume so. And same goes with Cameron Brink, who I think a lot of people have her going to the LA Sparks, which already has a pretty decent following anyways. But, you know, just add that to the list of people as well. Wherever Angel Reese goes in this draft, is that going to bring a lot more of following to those teams as well? So, it feels like And Sabrina Ionescu, I think is how you say it. I apologize. Who was at Oregon and then went into the WNBA. She went to New York, if I remember correctly. She kind of had a similar situation as well. But Caitlin Clark is kind of elevated to a whole new other level compared to Sabrina coming out of college. So anyways, yeah, it'll be interesting. We're going to see, I think, a lot more fans heading into this upcoming WNBA season than I think we had seen before. And the ratings for this national championship game, I would have to assume, are going to be bonkerous. They're going to be huge. They're probably going to pull like a NFL Sunday type of rating, which men's college basketball has not done all year. And of course, we're heading into the national championship tonight for men's college basketball. We'll see if the ratings are good on that. Also, I do think that the time, the tip time for the women's national championship game, I'm hoping that the NCAA kind of learned something from this. 3 o'clock Eastern on a Sunday, it's perfect. That's it, perfect for me. I don't want to do 9 o'clock in the evening Eastern time for the men's college basketball game, men's college national championship on a Monday. I can't do it anymore. I hate it. They do this for the football national championship as well. They put it on a Monday at like 7:30 p.m. on my time. Like, you're asking the people on the East Coast to stay up till 9:30 at the start of the game. It's ridiculous. Put it on a Saturday. Put it on a Sunday. Something like that. Please. I hate the Monday national championship games. I hate it. College football for the whole year is a weekend game. It's a Saturday game. It's a Saturday sport. You watch it on Saturdays. You take a nice little mid-afternoon nap on a Saturday. Wake up. You got the evening games or what have you. And then all of a sudden, when the national championship comes around, guess what? Hey, we're putting it on a Monday. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And the same goes for college basketball. College basketball is a little bit different. They play a bunch of different times, but they mainly play on weekends. That's normally when they play, because that's when they can get out of class and whatnot. The students can leave for the weekend, go to their games and whatnot. They have some, you know, weekday games every now and again, obviously, but it's primarily a weekend. It's a weekend game. And then guess what? They put it on a Sunday, which is perfect, because you know why? Because it's a weekend game. They can go back on a Monday. They can go back to school on Monday. Everybody's watching on a Sunday. I just hope they take, please. I'm begging the networks. Just move it to a Saturday. Move it to a Sunday, like the women's college national championship. Move the men's national championship to a Saturday or Sunday, and everybody will be happier. Move the national championship for college football to a Sunday or a Saturday, and everybody will be happier. I'm just crossing my fingers for that. I really hope that change happens.
Hi, it's Kathleen and Jack from 307 Real Estate.
If you're thinking of buying a property in the near future, the first thing you should do is call your banker or a home loan company and get pre-qualified. That way, you'll know in advance how much you can borrow for your dream home.
Great advice, Kathleen. There's nothing worse than finding that perfect home and then finding out you don't qualify. Once qualified, give us a call and we can start looking for that perfect home.
We're a Wyoming-based company and here for you, Wyoming.
Call Kathleen and Jack at 307 Real Estate, 307-763-1249. You're in heaven living in 307.
Okay, moving on. Given the women's game, their props, thank you to them very much. Good games. Awesome stuff. Let's move on. We got some things. I was complimenting the MLB for a little bit there. I do think the minor league system is great for testing out these new rule changes and whatnot, but they're really going through an issue right now. The MLB is, they got issues. They've got some issues outside of the rule changes and whatnot. The strike zone issue is still a problem. I hate to single people out, but Angel Hernandez is always the one guy that you can kind of think of as the person that's the problem behind home plate. I'm not singling him out, but that's the first person that it comes to everybody's mind. And I don't lie to me in saying it's not. That's the first person. The umpiring system just probably needs to change. It's going through a weird situation. The Fanatics problem. Wow. I mean, that has been a mess. I saw a video the other day of somebody who ordered a Chinese knockoff of a like the same exact jersey they could have gotten from Fanatics, and the jersey that they got, the Chinese knockoff version of the jersey, got was like $25 or something like that, and an official MLB worn jersey from Fanatics is like $145 or something like that, and the design elements and the stitching and everything is more prominent and more well done on the Chinese knockoff of the jersey. Everything is stitched on the jersey. The lettering and whatnot is stitched. The numbers are stitched onto the jersey. And then in the Fanatics, it's screened. It's so upsetting. It's the biggest mistake I think the MLB has made in terms of just a PR disaster for them, because not only the fans hate it, the players despise the uniforms that they have on. They hate them. There's been numerous videos of them, of players coming out saying how much they hate the uniforms, how bad they look, how much worse they look than last year's. And it's just been an absolute PR nightmare. And there's nothing they can do about it now. They can't change the situation. They've already sent out, Fanatics has already sent out all the uniforms that can be sold at the team store and whatnot. And it's not going to change. It's not going to change, which sucks. Because we're going to have to see it for the rest of this year. And, you know, eventually we'll probably get used to it, whatever. But it just doesn't, like, you compare the two from last year to this year, and it's crazy how drastic of a downgrade it is compared to last year's uniforms. We're seeing videos of Yankees players who are just sweating right through the shirts that they're getting, and you can see all these the sweat stains and whatnot. It's awful. Pants are still see-through on some of the uniforms. It's terrible. And I've read a couple places that some ball teams have not gotten their alternate uniforms from Fanatics yet. They haven't gotten all of their uniforms, which is also insane. We're almost, 2 weeks into the season now, and there's teams that still have not gotten alternate uniforms, so they don't have to wear the same, you know, home road combination every single game. That's crazy. That is absolutely insane. The fact that is a huge problem that they're having is wild. And I don't know how the MLB gets out of this. I don't know if Fanatics, this would be a terrible deal if they did sign this, but if they're on a year-to-year basis, there's not a situation in which I could see them coming back. No shot. But I would not imagine that is the deal that they would sign, because that would be stupid. So it's probably some sort of long-term deal that they signed with the MLB. We're going to have to stick with these jerseys for God knows how long. And, you know, Fanatics could make the changes heading into next season. Not saying they won't, but they could. You know, there's no reason to believe that they're going to make those changes, because, you know, heading into next season, it's cheaper, one, for them to make them this way, obviously. And they're still probably making a decent amount of money off of them, even though the PR disaster has been a PR disaster. So that's just been one of the things, not to mention your global superstar, the number one guy that everybody thinks of when they think of professional Major League Baseball right now is Shohei Ohtani. And he has caught up in a betting scandal, whether it was him or not. His interpreter essentially stole millions of dollars off of the person he was interpreting for, Shohei Ohtani. Apparently Shohei had no idea about this. There's just a lot of red flags in a lot of that story, to be honest with you. And I don't know if Shohei was gambling or not, to be honest with you. But if he wasn't gambling, the fact that he was just getting ripped off of millions and millions of dollars from this person that was right next to him, essentially, he has to have the worst bank, the worst agent, the worst money manager, the worst interpreter, obviously, in the history of all of those things. You can't just had, like, if for $2 million to just be ripped from your account and it's not your name, the name of the person is not yours that's going to the account and ripping that money out, there's got to be some lines that are, like, kind of jumped over in order for that to happen. You know, like, so it's just, it's red flags for me. I don't understand it. I don't get it. So that's an entire disaster that they have to kind of waddle their way around and try to figure out, and not essentially cover it up, but, you know, make people look the other way while they're investigating that. They weren't even going to investigate it when it first came out. They were like, yeah, the translator stole the money. Case closed. That's it. Thanks for coming. And then there was such an outcry, a public outcry of what was going on, that they were like, okay, we'll open a public investigation. Whatever. Fine, we'll do it. So yeah, that's an entire situation. Not to mention, and this is, to be honest with you, the thing that I'm about to bring up is even worse than the Shohei Ohtani stuff, because you have a team in the MLB, and this is unbelievable for me to say, that is actively just choosing to lose games so they can get out of the place that they're playing at quicker. That is what's happening. Anybody that tells you differently that is what is happening in Oakland is incorrect. The faster that they lose more games, the faster they're going to get out of Oakland, and the happier that the ownership group in Oakland is going to be. I can't remember a time in which I have seen a team so poorly put together and so poorly managed that I actively thought to myself, they don't want to win. Like, and this isn't on the players necessarily. I'm sure they are trying their hardest. I have no, you know, there's no inclination to believe that they're just throwing games or anything like that. But the grouping of players that they have put together in the front offices of Oakland, there's no reason to believe that they're actually trying to compete and put a team out there that is their, you know, the best of the best quality. And it feels like ownership and management in Oakland is just doing that so that the A's fans eventually just get more angry at the players than the management with the fact of how poorly that owner, that team has been run over the past 25 years, it feels like, maybe longer than that. Moneyball, you know, the movie is fantastic. The story of Moneyball is great. But now it's kind of gotten to this point where, like, when it first started happening and when they were going on those runs in basically from 2002 till mid-2010s, where they would have just a random spurt here or there where they would win 97 games, win the division, and then get bounced from the divisional or whatever. That was fun when that was happening. But now you kind of look back on it and you're like, yeah, they were using analytics before kind of everybody else was, in a way that was helping, you know, find value where there wasn't really seen as any value from players out on the, you know, on the field that nobody else had seemed to put any value on. But now it's to a point where they see the value and they're like, this might help us too much. We can't have our ticket sales go too high because then we can't justify us leaving. If that makes sense. That's what it feels like where we're at with where the Athletics are. It's just so disappointing. It's so confusing because Oakland, they can fill out that stadium. They love their Athletics. Okay. We have seen on those runs or those that god awful stadium, the Oakland Coliseum, that just terrible, the last of the cookie cutter stadiums, that truly, truly awful stadium is filled to the brim with Oakland Athletics fans. It's one of the better ballpark, one of the better ballpark environments when it's filled to the brim with Athletics fans. And we haven't seen it like that except for when Athletics fans are showing up to protest and show, hey, yeah, we're still here. And that happened last year where they filled the stadium. They were quiet for a whole inning or whatever. And then once the inning was over, they made as much noise as possible just to kind of show everybody, yeah, we're still here. We still want to watch the Athletics, but we don't want to do it under this terrible ownership group that is basically selling the team that they've been fans for the last, you know, however long they've been in Oakland, and selling it to go to Las Vegas. And why? And John Fisher, who is the owner of the Oakland Athletics, is so keen to get out of Oakland, this place that has treated him somewhat, that team, very well for the last however long. He is so keen on getting out of Oakland and moving to Las Vegas as soon as possible, mainly just getting out of Oakland, that he's willing to move his team to a AAA, AA stadium, whatever it is, in Sacramento, and have them play there and just wait it out until they have their Las Vegas stadium built. Which is such a slap in the face of Oakland A's fans. By the way, when they move to Las Vegas, which is going to happen probably 2028, something like that, do they really think that the game of baseball is going to sell well in, especially the Oakland style of baseball, is going to sell well in Las Vegas? Las Vegas is built on star power. They have shows of stars. They have, you know, the entire thing that Las Vegas is. And Oakland has never, ever, 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 ever spent on stars. That's like the entire opposite of what they've believed in. That's never been what the Oakland A's have been, especially in the last 25 years. The entire Moneyball concept is, yeah, we don't pay for stars. We have to find these smaller guys that nobody wants to turn into Oakland Athletic players. And they play well, and we put together a team that ends up winning well. And then guess what? The player that was good on that team that nobody remembers ends up going to a different place and performs well or does not perform well in that other place. Just to give you a small list of people, for example, Max Muncy leaves the Oakland A's, becomes a very solid starting third baseman and first baseman for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Matt Olson becomes the home run leader from last year for the Atlanta Braves. Sean Murphy, everyday starting catcher for the champion starting Braves, Atlanta Braves. Josh Donaldson wins an MVP in Toronto. Mark Canha, another solid player that played for the A's for a while. Kendall Graveman goes to Houston. I believe won a championship with this Houston team 2 years ago, if I remember correctly. Marcus Semien, one of the great players, just won a championship with the Texas Rangers. Matt Chapman, another great infielder, third baseman, went on to play some very prominent years in Toronto, now playing with the San Francisco Giants. Sonny Gray is another name. Chris Bassett's and Jonah Heim is another name, one of the better catchers in the entire league, who plays for the Texas Rangers now. It's just they have this, sure, they have this ability to find players that nobody wants or whatever. They turn these players around, they turn them into good players, and then when they're actually becoming good players, they're like, yeah, we don't want them no more because they cost too much money. And now, because the Moneyball thing isn't really working, because now everybody has this analytical department, they know what they're looking for at this point. They're just a bad team. They're just a bad team. That's all they are now. And that's not going to change when they go to Las Vegas. They're not going to have the star power in Las Vegas because the owner, John Fisher, doesn't want to pay for the star power in Oakland. So when he gets to Las Vegas, you know what's going to happen? They're going to do more of the Moneyball stuff. They're going to try to just find the diamonds in the rough, if you will, even though there's more and there's better department analytical departments all around the league now. Ever since that Moneyball era, there's better teams doing it with better analytics. And now they're going to have to, they're right back where they were when, you know, Moneyball was become, they're the last dog at the bull now, just in a different scenario. And then even if they do hit on a draft pick or whatever, John Reed, the owner, or John Reed, I keep wanting to call him John Reed, John Fisher, excuse me, does not want to pay for the star power. And that's all Las Vegas is. Las Vegas is star power. That's what they want. The A's don't have the traveling the traveling camaraderie that the Raiders do from Las Vegas to Oakland, now to Las Vegas. One, because it's, you know, the NFL, you're always going to pull more fans of the NFL. And two, Oakland is so all of Oakland A's fans are so left with such a bad taste in their mouth with how poorly this transition has gone, that why would any Oakland A fan want to root for them when they go to Las Vegas? Why would they want to do that? It's just, it's so stupid. It's just, it's absurd to me. I've never called, I think Dan Snyder was the last guy, and that's mainly because of just the disaster that was the front office in terms of, you know, how inappropriate and everything was down with Dan Snyder when he was running the Washington football team. I think I called for him to sell the team, but man, Fisher is just running it into the ground so that he can leave, essentially, with the Oakland A's and go to Las Vegas. But he's going to run it the same way. There's still going to be a bad team in Las Vegas that are going to be outperformed analytically because everybody does what they used to do now, just better and more expensive. So they're now just exactly in the same scenario that they were back in the early 2000s, where they're now the last dog at the bull analytically. Everybody is now looking for those diamonds in the roughs in the same way that the Athletics did back in the early 2000s. So they're just right back to square one. And for whatever reason, John Fisher thinks that that is still going to work for the Athletics for the most part. Now, today, in today's world, I don't think that John Fisher is actively going out and trying to put a good, like, I will absolutely stand by that accusatory comment. I don't think he is willing to spend money to put a good ball team on the field in Oakland. If it were up to him, I would imagine he would just skip this season, just get to 2025 so he can go to Sacramento for 3 years and then just get to Las Vegas where his new stadium is going to be and where he's going to start over, even though I don't think he's going to spend the money to try to keep the stars there either. That's what he wants. I don't think he actually wants to play these games or wants to be part of a team that is playing these games. And that's just disappointing because Oakland, one, that's a very proud city of their Oakland Athletics. They love that team, as evident by the playoff games that they would go to. There's a lot of players that would say Oakland is a very tough ballpark to play in during the playoffs because of how many people show up and how loud it gets in that stadium. So anyways, I'm going on a tangent. It's just disappointing because, you know, DMLB now has a problem, and it's that. It's the blemish that the Oakland A's are, because they're actively not looking to try to win ball games because it's not going to help John Fisher in any way to try to move. The less people that show up to those games, the better off. And then, you know, vice versa, if more people show up to those games, you're just going to fill the pockets of John Fisher. And he's gonna be like, all right, cool. I have the rucksack of money on my, around my shoulder as I run out the door. So it's just disappointing. The whole thing is such a disaster and the only people that get hurt here are Oakland A's fans. That's the only people that it hurts. And it's sad because I know they have a very strong fan base in Oakland, but they're just so disappointed in the way the team ran, and they're going to lose another team. Now they lost, obviously, the Raiders. They're going to lose the Athletics. They kind of lost the Warriors because the Warriors moved over to the Bay. So it's disappointing because there's clearly a fan base there. There's clearly a fan base there. But Fisher doesn't want anything to do with it. So anyways, tangent over. That is it. That's my tangent. That's going to wrap it up, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for tuning in. Appreciate it very much. Please remember to leave a rating on this episode, this podcast, wherever you can, wherever you get your podcasting platforms. We'll be back here next week talking some more whatever the heck's happening. Talk whatever's happening. We'll talk whatever we want to talk about. So just expect that. I've been your host, James Timberlake, and this has been the Weekend Sports Wrap Podcast.